You're listening to the Cannabis Investing Network. Before we begin, a short disclaimer. The full disclaimer follows at the end of this episode. This podcast is a general communication and is being provided for entertainment and information purposes only. It is educational in nature and is not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment strategy, plan, feature, or other purpose. Please enjoy responsibly. Hello and welcome back to the Cannabis Investing Network podcast. My name is Manish, and oh, do we have a jam-packed episode for everybody today. We have all eyes on Germany, the EU, legalization kind of maybe sort of, and what that means. And I'm very excited to be rejoining us is Will Mucke of Artemis Growth Partners. Welcome back to the program, Will.
Thank you, Manish. Good to be back.
So, Will, it's been quite some time since we last chatted. There have been some very interesting developments, which you're going to help us understand today, as well as the context of what they mean. But I guess just to start, how exciting is what just happened on Friday with the legalization in the German parliament?
Well, for us, it's very exciting. It's funny. We've had conversations over the past, I don't know, year or more with other folks that have been watching the headlines and have been so disappointed by the state of progress in Germany, because when this latest government came to power, there were promises around full legalization, full decriminalization, and everyone thought, okay, California is now about to be inserted into or built from what the base points are in the statute in Germany. And so while we don't have kind of everything under the sun available in a beautiful Apple Store-like dispensary, what we do have is a step forward, a very significant step forward, not only for Germany, but for all of Europe, with Germany kind of being the engine on the European cannabis train, saying that cannabis as of April 1st, if we go through this first process that was passed on Friday, and then the next step, which is we can talk about in detail, is in the third week of March. When we get through all of these steps, you'll see the first legal sales of non-narcotic status cannabis happening in Germany. And as
but just to be clear, you're saying there won't be a MedMen Germany that we can shop at?
Well, not yet. What we're going to have is an expansion of the medical market. So why it's so exciting for us is we are already investors in the medical supply chain, not only in Germany, but in Europe broadly. And this not only codifies where we want cannabis to go, which is a non-narcotic controlled substance, but non-narcotic status medicinal, it will expand the market. It will remove these constraints around what cannabis has been limited to as far as doctors writing prescriptions, and will open up for almost any indication in the professional opinion of a doctor. Any general practitioner can now prescribe cannabis for a multitude of medical conditions. And so we see the market expanding rapidly because of this. And I think that's just a good thing for patients, for actually crime enforcement, for national health plans, and ultimately for operators and investors in the cannabis space.
Well, that's great. I think that's a great place to start. So, you know, just the agenda for today is we're going to be digging into some serious detail about what just happened and what that means, and what that means for the program, as well as the companies, which companies are going to be the biggest beneficiaries, and then the domino effects that could have for Europe, USA, and even, you know, before we started, Will, we were chatting about, you know, how the capital markets in Europe might open up for the cannabis industry, which we'll touch on later. But just, Will, like just to frame the conversation, because it's been a while since we chatted, just if you don't mind, remind us quickly about Artemis Growth Partners. And, you know, you guys have a very sizable portfolio, but mostly, I think, private names. So just give us a little bit of context of who you guys are and, you know, the size of what you guys do.
Sure. So we started as a specialty cannabis investor in 2017, really started making early investments in 2018. We now manage, I think, just under $400 million of U.S. Dollar assets under management across the broad cannabis supply chain. Our history was that we started in the U.S. and invested in state legal businesses, followed really sort of the progression of the deregulatory environment around the world. So started investing in the Caribbean and in Latin America as those markets opened up. And actually early in 2018, we took a jump into Europe to say that we think this market's going to be a very interesting market. And we started investing in a Danish business and then looking at Europe as an opportunity, given that the demographics of Europe, 750 million people, when you stitch together all the countries, is a really large and robust space. So I think we're seen as one of the more active institutional investors in cannabis. It's all we do. We don't do psychedelics. We don't do other things outside of cannabis. And so we've been a specialty player in cannabis and in that leadership seat for a couple of years now.
Yeah. So, you know, roughly 400 million US, right? And it's almost entirely in private companies. I know maybe some companies have gone public since, but I mean, that's obviously very, very significant. And it's funny to hear you talk about the timeframes, you know, 2017, 2018, because I got involved in this industry from an investment perspective in 2017. And pretty quickly, I would say maybe it was 2018, there were already the talk about Germany and Europe and how, you know, you had to be there, 750 million people, high income, it's coming, it's coming. So here we are, right? I mean, 6-7 years later, and there's
highly, right?
We're getting there, right? We're getting there. Not quite there yet, but you know, it's nice to see some progress, right? So I think that's a great reason for, you know, to just help frame the conversation. People can help understand, you know, how deeply involved you guys are, not just in Germany, but, you know, in different countries across the world. So now let's actually get into it, right? Last time you were on here, we talked in depth about the model in Europe and the model in Germany and how it might change with the coming legalization. So let's actually talk about what just passed, and, you know, give us an idea of that framework of what does that actually mean. I know it's not fully done yet, there's some little steps that have to happen, but if that goes through as presented right now, what would that mean for the German cannabis market?
Sure. So I'll take a step back. When this most recent government came to power, part of their political platform was to legalize cannabis. That started with a discussion around the medical program that was already in place and had been in place since 2018, but expanding that medical program and bringing in this idea of decriminalization and descheduling of cannabis from narcotic to non-narcotic status. Part of that was also because they call this government the Traffic Light Coalition. It's a group of the Green Party, the SPD, and another liberal party that kind of have come together to sit in government. And they promoted cannabis through their health minister as a new opportunity to, one, lower overall health costs for Germany, two, to de-emphasize the over-policing of sort of marginalized communities and actually save on police dollars spent for kind of worthless policing, I should say. And the third point was to open up this idea of personal consumption as a legal right. And so the process in Germany is you put the statute forward, you have debate and discussion in the Houses of Parliament, and then you go through a process where you have final debates and votes in both the Bundestag, which is sort of the lower house, and then the Bundesrat, which is the upper house. And once those two phases are passed, you then are codifying your statute into law, and that will be the prevailing law for the country. So what happened on Friday was the first step and probably the most important step in this process, which was the Bundestag. The lower house voted, they had their final debates, and they voted on cannabis as a two-pillar process. I'll talk about that in a second. But the first pillar is what they were voting on Friday. Okay. And a majority vote, 407 votes to 226 votes, the statute passed in the lower house. And what's really sort of euphoric for Germany about that is the next step, which is third week of March, going through the Bundesrat. It's really, it's a process-oriented step, but it's not a necessary step to codify the law around cannabis. In fact, if anything, it is the potential sticking point if there were to be a group of a large enough group of naysayers, they could block the law. But it looks like at this point that they don't have the votes to block. And so what happened on Friday should carry through in the third week of March to finalize the second step and then open up cannabis as a non-narcotic status and expand the medical program as it exists today in Germany.
Okay, so let's just pause there for a second, right? Just to make sure we take in what we're saying. Mm-hmm. So last time we chatted, and as you mentioned, when this stoplight party first came to power, I think there was maybe a more expansive idea that was put forward in terms of changing the, you know, actually legalizing cannabis as opposed to what we have now. So just quickly, if you don't mind, give us a breakdown of what was proposed, right? And then where did we actually end up?
So I think where we wound up is actually what finally came out of discussion into law. So it's not like they really retrenched. There was a lot of campaigning around this is going to be a much more open market, and we're going to have more of a retail sort of consumer facing commercial opportunity in cannabis. That really never made it into the law. In fact, as they went through the public debate and they were going through the discussions around what the actual statute was going to be that they were going to vote on, a lot of those kind of more speculative pieces fell out. And so what came into play was a two-tier or two-pillar program. The first pillar being cannabis as a non-narcotic status, that individuals could have a possession in their house and a possession that they could carry sort of 50 grams in the house, 25 grams outside of their house. They would have three plants that they could cultivate individually, and that they would be able to create kind of clusters of what they're calling cannabis clubs. 500 people could get together, almost think about it almost as like a wine club in California. Okay. And they could cultivate 1500 plants and have a non-commercial, no money changing hands, but a non-commercial trade of cannabis amongst sort of those individuals. So that was pillar one. Pillar two was a more speculative step, and it's still sort of a wait to see how this unfolds. But pillar two is a five-year scientific program where they will establish certain points of contact for consumers to actually buy adult use legal recreational cannabis. And that has a component of domestic cultivation, domestic processing, and domestic sale. That pillar two has not yet been really fully formulated and ratified. So what we're focused on right now is just pillar one, with the idea that pillar two, which actually looks very much like what both the Netherlands and Switzerland already have in place today, that pillar two is kind of pushed off to the side for now, but pillar one has passed the lower house and likely will pass the upper house and will have this non-narcotic status, personal consumption decriminalization. It's not exactly what I think many of the very liberal left-leaning voters wanted, but it really hits a giant sweet spot for the industry, for patient advocacy, for enforcement, and ultimately tax revenues and public health savings. So it captures, I'd say, a very large majority of what had been promised in the campaigns, and it captures that entire pillar one of what had been written into statute and is now going to be codified.
Yeah, and real progress too, right? I mean, I think
absolutely.
I think, you know, if you think about cannabis as a political issue, the beauty of it is how relatable it is to a lot of people. And there's a lot of people outside of the system of voting, people who don't typically vote. I mean, if you think about, you know, in the US, in general, I think Western countries, like the voting percentage is maybe 50-50, right? In terms of who actually shows up for an election, and sometimes less than that. So there's a big chunk of the population, especially younger people, who just don't care, right? Or maybe they do care, but they're not going to actually show up and vote. And I think sometimes we lose sight of the fact that when you show people a tangible change in their life, that has an impact, right? It's a meaningful impact. So even if you don't get everything you want, as it sounds like, you know, from a business standpoint, you're not really getting a legal marketplace for sales. And, you know, that has some drawbacks, I think, for sure. But it is real change in people's lives. And when that happens, it's very, I would say it's basically impossible to go backwards from that, right? When people are used to having that, it's basically impossible for somebody to come and repeal that.
Absolutely. I mean, the as they say, the genie is out of the bottle now. And I think it's not just for Germany, but really for Europe writ large. We don't yet have kind of an omnibus overarching set of statutes for the EU. But you can very quickly see, as other EU countries raise their hands, and there are already, you know, 17 plus medical programs in the EU actively in place, state-sponsored programs today, you can see the progression that this could move forward. So right now, a consumer, really a patient who wants to have access to cannabis, they have to get a script to get that. Mm-hmm. But the bar is now lowered on the doctors who can prescribe, how they can prescribe. So it really widens that market. At some point in time in the future, and in Germany, it looks like they want to and need to go through their scientific pilot program first, gather that data, and then make a decision. But at some point in time, 5+ years from now, you will see that there will be, at least in certain places in Europe, if not widespread, the opportunity for a consumer, not necessarily a patient, but a consumer to get legal access to commercially buy cannabis without a prescription. Mm-hmm. But right now you have to have a prescription, but in the future that will be open for the opportunity to have direct commercial sales.
Yeah. And one thing I want to point out is, you know, a lot of times on the medical side in the US, the programs, like we say, you know, there's a difference between medical programs, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times a medical program, let's look at like Texas, for example, the reason that medical program is so limited is because the regs around who can access the cannabis, it's very restrictive. But then we say, you know, when a program, I think the two big things are chronic pain and anxiety. When those conditions get added to what's permissible, the program really expands because, yeah, you know, those are conditions that allow a lot of people to enter the program, right? So I want to just point out, it's very important what you're saying about that idea of the program expanding thanks to these rules. So just before we talk about that, though, last time we chatted, I remember a big issue with what was being proposed was that they would have to go to the European Union for approval, essentially, and float the plan. And, you know, we always get hung up on, you know, the treaties, right? And the fact that you're going to violate a treaty, even though Canada has done it and doesn't seem to really be an issue. No one else is. It always seems to be a sticking point legal terms. So I guess I'm curious, the changes that were made, were those based on domestic political considerations, or were those based on, I can't remember if it's United Nations or the EU, but was that based on international law and feedback from those entities?
So I think the last time we talked, they had not yet gone to the EU High Commission to kind of bless, if you will, the statute that was going to be voted on in Germany. Mm-hmm. That since has gone through, and Brussels has at least tacitly opined that Germany is not violating any laws within the EU. On the UN Single Convention and sort of the ability of cannabis to move across borders and what that means as far as overall kind of world policing of cannabis, right now under the UN Single Convention, if you are a medical state, if you have a federally legal medical program, you can send your cannabis from one federally legal jurisdiction to another. So you can cross borders in Europe. You can go from Spain to France. You can go from France to Germany. Those issues are allowed today under the UN Single Convention. The question had always been, are we opening up a quasi-legal recreational market where you're going to have commercial trade of imported cannabis that's going to be sold effectively to a consumer? That mm-hmm. still hasn't happened. That would violate international law. That would violate the UN Single Convention, and that would violate also EU statute. So
right.
That. So,
sorry, just to pause, I want to make sure, just yep. in case people don't know, right now you can ship cannabis internationally for medicinal purposes. So there is, it's not easy. It's extremely complicated, but there is importation of cannabis, say from Canada to Israel, you know, for medical purposes. And similarly from, Israel to Germany, for example, to help fill domestic need. But again, only medicinally, and the recreational becomes the barrier, right? I just want to make sure I'm understanding. Did the EU give positive feedback on the original plan, which was sort of the full rec plan? Or I very
really
hazily...
Pillar one, okay. Pillar two idea. That's mm-hmm. Pillar two is as long as it's cloaked in a scientific experiment, it's allowable. It would be
Got
different
it.
If they said, we're going to just open up 10 states, and these 10 states are going to have legal dispensaries, and people are going to go in, you know, over 18 and buy. That would be that wouldn't work. But because it's a scientific program run by the state, and it's going to be a study from which the data will be analyzed, and whatever the next step will be decided on that data, that's permissible under EU law. So that walked through okay. But again, this omnibus idea of California all of a sudden, you know, de novo springing up in Germany, that's not happening. And that wouldn't be allowed to happen under current statute.
Got it. So let's talk about where we're going to be. You know, if April 1st, everything goes as planned. It sounds to me, looking at it from afar, this is basically just like a decrim program, right? You can have it on you. You can grow, you know, a couple plants in your house. You can, you know, have these, I think they said 500 clubs. Is it 500 clubs or 500 members in a club? I can't
500
remember.
Members in a club. So you can have multiple clubs, but okay. The clubs are restricted to a total membership of 500 individuals.
Is there a cap on the number of clubs?
You know, I actually don't know. If there is, it hasn't popped up as a topical point. I'm not sure that's been decided yet.
Got it.
But as far as the number of individuals in any given club, that has been capped.
Okay. So basically, I mean, these are very core elements of decrim, right? I mean, people can have it. There's less policing around it. People aren't going to get arrested for it, you know, as long as they're within the rules. And even then, I mean, if somebody has, you know, more than 25 grams, they're probably fine, right? It becomes more of a non-issue, I guess.
A traffic ticket than it is, you know, a go to jail and something that's on
your permit. Right. So I think a lot of people can get behind that, right? And I think we've seen that in the U.S. as well, where when you talk legalization, there's a lot of thorny issues that have to be kicked around. When you talk decrim, it's sort of like, hey, it's fine. You know, we're more or less turning a blind eye to it. And there's some small instances where you can grow it legally, right? And this club concept is kind of novel compared to what we've seen in the U.S. Home grow, you know, which I think a lot of people would be happy about. But ultimately, commercially, this doesn't really move the needle, or does it? Because you made some comments about how the medical program is changing. So let's talk about that. What does that actually mean for the medical program and the operators there?
So the largest beneficiaries of this next step in the legalization of cannabis in Germany, well, one is the patient, because they now have much more ready access. Going back to your points about how medical cannabis moves across borders, right now, Germany has had open borders for medical cannabis to come into the state. It's actually created, at times, an oversupply of product. But what it's done from a commercial standpoint, it's lowered the price of cannabis to a level where it's at or below what you can price a gram of cannabis in the illicit market.
Interesting.
So if Germany has, call it 4 to 5 million illicit users of cannabis, basically patients who are self-prescribing today, and they're going to an illegal dealer or basically buying street cannabis. The incentive now is, well, one is that if you qualify for the state program, theoretically you can be reimbursed. And if you qualify, you can be reimbursed by either the state directly or by one of the state private insurance companies that effectively underwrite medical prescriptions in Germany. So as a patient, you now have access to a very vibrant, you know, multimodal cannabis market. And when I say multimodal, that's more of points of contact of different cannabis, different strains coming in, because in Germany, you're still restricted to flower and oil. Like, you don't have finished product yet. We can talk about that if you want to. But the biggest beneficiary is the patient, because you have now safe cannabis that comes with a certificate of authenticity. And you know that it has no pesticides, no mold, no heavy metals, and it's safe to consume.
And obviously, reimbursement is huge, right? How realistic is it? Is it theoretical, or are most patients actually getting reimbursed for their purchases?
I'd say, you know, our guess is that it's about one third reimbursed and two thirds private pay.
Interesting.
And a lot of that is because many of the folks that are moving from the illicit market into the legal market, you know, they have their own kind of menu of what they like, what they're looking for. And again, because there's now so much supply coming into Germany, you can go to a website, and I'm not trying to plug our companies, but there's some great websites that have sort of 95% or more of the cannabis that's available by dispensary. And the patient really has a lot of power to kind of choose who prescribe, you know, what their doctor says is, here's your script. It's actually denoting both the manufacturer and the strain. But the patient could take that script and go to a pharmacy and say, look, you're out of this strain that my doctor provided. You, the pharmacist, you have legal authority to say, you know, what my options are under this script. And they can kind of almost strain hunt around Germany to find the pharmacy that dispenses the cannabis that they like. And they're willing to pay for that out of pocket. And so it creates this very robust market for the patient. In the end, the knock-on effect for folks like ourselves that are investing in the supply chain is that those cannabis operators that are importing, wholesaling, or selling in a pharmacy, their cannabis strains, those are the true beneficiaries from the economic impact of what these new statutes, as they go into law, will reap on the industry. Because if you're in the legal supply chain right now, our portfolio company Bloomwell, they disqualify 6 out of every 7 patients that come to their site. And it's for a number of technical reasons. It could be, you know, administrative reasons, but a lot of that is because cannabis today is prescribed as a last tier of defense. So you have to fail 2 traditional therapies for your indication before you can get access to cannabis. In this new world, you don't need to fail other therapies. Your doctor can say, you know what, if you have shoulder pain after surgery, you know what, opioids are terrible. They give you constipation. They screw up your appetite. People are worried about long-term effects of taking long-term opiates. Why don't you try cannabis? And that patient can then go to a website, you know, go through the doctor prescribing channel and get a script, and then go to the website and choose the cannabis that they want. And so anyone who is now in that legal supply chain will not only have access to 1 out of every 7 patients, but will have access to all 7 patients.
And so, let's just repeat what you just said.
Yep.
So just to summarize, right now, you have to go to a doctor and say, look, I've tried, you know, XYZ pain management technique, right? And it hasn't worked for me. And then you can get cannabis.
Correct.
But that's going to go away entirely.
Correct. You still have a conversation with your doctor, but it's now up to your doctor to say, I know you as a patient. I think that this could be an interesting choice for you as a medication, and let's try cannabis.
And is there, similar to the US, where they have, you know, conditions? Like, can you, like, for example, like if you have anxiety, right? Then previously, maybe you had to try some kind of anti-anxiety medication, just as an example, and then you could try cannabis. Like, am I on the right path here, or is it totally different?
And that goes away. Now you don't have to fail another therapy to have access to cannabis. You can have a conversation and have cannabis prescribed as the first line of defense. And so from a patient standpoint and a doctor standpoint, it kind of takes the state out of it. It allows the medical practitioner to really use the full complement of their resources and skills. And every doctor still needs to be trained on cannabis, but it's not a difficult training process. And it's more worries about contraindications and drug-on-drug interaction. Once a doctor has that education already done, and there still is a continuing medical education process that doctor must stay current with, but it allows any GP now to prescribe cannabis without waiting for, you know, you patient XYZ to fail 2 other therapies. And so you may not get all 7 patients. Like, a lot of those folks may still fall out for certain reasons, but it expands the market in a very big way and immediately. And so we talk about just the script volume, which there are now about 300,000 legal patients on the patient roll in Germany. We can easily see that going up to 1 million patients. We can easily see a trebling of that patient roll. And that's just touching on likely people that are migrating from the illicit market to the legal market. It's not even talking about the folks that maybe have never experienced cannabis before as medicinal. And now that's part of the doctor tool set to play with as they think through therapy.
So just repeat that again. How many patients right now?
So there are about 300,000 patients on the legal medical roll in Germany. And
that's pretty significant. I mean,
illicit patients.
Sorry, 300,000 legally right now, and how many illicit?
And about 4 million plus, 4 to 5 million plus estimated of illicit self-prescribing cannabis patients in Germany.
Yeah, and 300,000 is nothing to sneeze at. I mean, that's you're probably half or maybe a little less of the Florida market there with that size, right? And that's with a very restrictive program. So do you have an idea in terms of dollars how big the market is right now approximately?
So I'd say it's probably around €500 million as a revenue market today. And so we see this becoming a billion or multi-billion dollar market as we move from, I think in 2022, there were 21 tons of cannabis imported into Germany. And that was about a €490 million market. We can see that 21 tons easily grow to 100 tons. And we can see the €500 million plus or minus euro market going to a multi-billion dollar market. And so it's still very, I mean, if you think about this in the context of the US, I mean, Germany has 80 plus million people as a demographic. So these are still relatively small markets when you compare this to the size of, I don't know, it could be like Connecticut's market as far as revenue dollars with, you know, 10 times the population. So,
yeah, so and just how we think about that roughly, right, is if you take 80 million people and you look at, you know, let's say like Maryland or Illinois, right, you can get to somewhere around 100 to 150 ahead pretty comfortably. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 100 ahead, 80 million people is $8 billion, right? Now, euros, dollars, whatever. But that's
almost parity these days. We can almost use them interchangeably as far as the
currency. Yeah, they're almost one to one. That's right. So it's but 8 billion, I mean, would be, you know, larger than, you know, California, larger than Canada, right? I mean, these are massive numbers, right? And it makes sense because Germany is twice the size of California, twice the size of Canada. And so obviously it's a very interesting market when you say, hey, this could be $8, $10, $12 billion once you finally get there, right? But even starting today at 500 as a size and saying, hey, this market has a potential to double or triple, I mean, that's nothing to turn your nose at either.
Not at all. And if you're thinking about picking the best players in the field who are already in that supply chain, you start getting very excited about what your uplift could be for equity valuations and for ultimately an exit in any one investment or multiple investments. And I'd say, just going back to the market size, do keep a little bit of a tamp down on what total size could be, because we're only speaking about medical right now. We don't have the total TAM of a recreational market like a California. And we also only have right now the opportunity of going through a compounding pharmacy in Germany. So you effectively have flour and oil. One of our companies has the first vape that went on the market with some controversy around it, but it was the first sort of legal scripts written for vape. We think that's going to be a very large category at some point in time. Mm-hmm. But you don't have everything else. I mean, if you look at our portfolio at Artemis, you know, some of our largest positions are in brands. We're in Cannes, we're in Kiva, we're in Raw Garden, and those are, you know, really robust business opportunities because they hit needs and modalities that consumers want. I think it would be wonderful to have finished product in Germany, but we don't have that yet. So there's a little bit of a limiting factor just because it's only flour and oil today and because we're medical only today. But again, if you roll forward, you can see this opening up to a much more broad-based market, even within medical. And ultimately, when you hit recreational, this will be a very big market. And again, you don't have to only focus on Germany. The great thing about the EU is it's like, you know, with this confederation of states, it's going to be the United States without these walled gardens, which are the state legality versus federal illegality. You will have, and already have, for example, Poland, 38.5 million people right next door that has a medical program. Mm-hmm. And so when you start seeing the aggregation of these medical programs across all of Europe, it becomes very large without needing to go to that recreational space. So we get very excited about the overall European supply chain, investing into that supply chain, and then seeing the leadership companies in Germany, hopefully taking a leadership role almost as platform plays across Europe as you start cobbling together, you know, the other leaders in Poland and Denmark and France, Italy. The UK is the weird place that's kind of left out of this, but we find this to be a very robust investment opportunity for all of Europe, just starting with Germany as the biggest, most populous nation in the EU.
Okay, so let's talk about, you know, I'm sure people have gotten the context of why this is exciting, you know, what to look forward to. Let's talk about actual names, right? So talk to me about, you know, your portfolio companies, other companies in the space. You know, obviously last time we chatted about Curaleaf and they had just done an acquisition, and I think they've done another one since that you were very positive on. So who is this going to benefit in Germany, right, along the supply chain? Who's the best position for it? And you know, what opportunities are available for investors out there?
So in our portfolio, where we invested in Germany is through a company called Bloomwell. And what Bloomwell has is it's sort of a three verticals under a holding company.
Okay.
Operated independently, but still working together to create, for the patient anyway, a complete supply chain. Mm-hmm. So they have Algea Care, which is a prescribing force and the largest private prescribing force in Germany, the largest private patient role. They have a company called Ilio Sante, which is a wholesaler and importer. So they bring product into Germany. And then they have a third vertical called Breezy, which is really the forward facing, almost the DTC side of the medical supply chain. And they have a website called Grüne Brise. And what Grüne Brise does is it lists not just Bloomwell's products, but all of the market's products through all the pharmacies. And they kind of give you an in-network and out-of-network choice as a patient. So if you get a script from the AlgeaCare doctor, you will be transferred, if you want, your choice, to the Grüne Brise site. If you come up on Grüne Brise, you can either choose to have it fulfilled by someone in-network, one of the pharmacies that have linked into this. What Grüne Brise is actually basically a hub for independent.
It's like a marketplace.
It's a marketplace. It's like Amazon. Okay. It's like Amazon for your medical cannabis.
Got it.
And so you can kind of shop and you can go on that and say, okay, I want this strain, this pharmacy. If you're in network, because it's through Iliosante, they will guarantee that you'll have your product between 24 and 72 hours, depending on if you're in an MSA or if you're in a rural region. But you'll get your cannabis at your door. If you're out of network, they can't guarantee any sort of delivery time, but you'll still be able to buy it. So it's a completely open, it's not a specialized place only funneling you into our product. It funnels you into the broader marketplace.
Okay, I missed the middle part. So they have the like three parts of the business. One is that it's the prescribing network of doctors.
Right? Correct.
The end point is that, you know, the marketplace, the Amazon of medical cannabis, if you will. And then what was the middle? Do they import? Do they grow?
In the middle, no, they don't grow. They do sort of everything but cultivation. So the middle piece is the importer, wholesaler, distributor of cannabis, and they kind of service the market by going out to the broader, both German and international cannabis cultivators and bring in product under their label, under the Breezy brand name.
So
you go through sort of door one, which is you talk to the doctor. It's a telemedicine play. You get your script. Mm-hmm. Door two is you actually go to the third point, which is the open marketplace. You see all the cannabis. You get to choose your cannabis. If you so happen to choose a Breezy brand, one of the company's own brands, then it is fulfilled by that second middle piece, which is the wholesaler. They have brought the cannabis into the country. They've packaged it and processed it under Breezy, and then you get it at your door. You can also get, because they handle other people's products as well, you can get a large number of other companies in that same delivery time zone because of this network of independent pharmacies that have linked into the Grüne Brise website. But it's really easy place for a patient to kind of, you know, do a one-stop shop from doctor to receipt of your cannabis medicine.
Okay, so talk to us, why is that, you know, you've been through the investment cannabis cycle, right? We've seen the importance of limited licenses, but then we've also seen over time how those can be eroded, right? So with that kind of mindset, talk to us about when you're coming into Germany, why is this a good place to be? Because, you know, you've got the doctor portion of that, right? And in Canada, at one point, that was a really big business that's basically gone away, right? And then you've got the importing part of it, which, you know, allows you to, I guess, source and pick and choose what you want and have good variety maybe, right? But I guess in an ideal world, would you be able to have cultivation as part of this mix? Do you not need it? Like, why is this a good place to be as a business?
So the reason that Bloomwell doesn't do cultivation and that we as a firm, we typically don't invest in cultivators is because that, for our view, is it's kind of the most commoditized or the high risk of commoditization really lies in cultivation. I think that the protection elements around cultivation or the cultivators in the world are low cost. So if you're in a low cost jurisdiction and you're able to grow at pennies per gram, you can really service almost all of these legal medical markets and still make money. I think the difficult thing for cultivation is depending on the jurisdiction that you're in, your input costs could be fine today, but as, again, pricing compresses, margins compress, that's the area that's likely going to be first hurt and left out in the cold as far as being able to make long-term sustainable profits. So, and it's also the most capital intensive stage of the supply chain. So Bloomwell chose to stay asset light, high sort of flywheel effect of cash flow in the business, and said, look, I have the entire world that I'm going to, entire legal medical cannabis world to source cannabis. So why don't I use market forces and just get the best, lowest cost product in through the Iliosante wholesaler and serve that up for patients to choose. But let's stick with, you know, taking a ticking fee on every sale that goes through the Grunebrisa website. And let's make sure that we have a service element that the doctors are there with the patient prescribing. The capture of sort of that complete supply chain allows them to do a lot to enhance the patient and doctor experience and still have a very well serviced pharmacy channel for patients to access. So for us, that seemed to be a very complete supply chain play into Germany without playing into the high CapEx side or the high commoditization side of cultivation and without being sort of left out, because you're right. I think that paying, you know, 100 euro right now for a script to get your prescription will likely go away over time. It's going to get squeezed for sure. And especially as other people come up to say, we have more doctors, more points of contact, you're not going to be able to make a lot of money just on the prescribing side. So you want to have, you know, the import-export margin as well as the retail margin or the quasi-retail margin to kind of fulfill that complete supply chain and still make money all the way through.
Who else is interesting in Germany? And maybe some of the bigger and public companies, you know, do they have an interesting angle in Germany?
So I think that Curaleaf has a really interesting footprint with Curaleaf International. And they started by buying EMAC, which I'm not sure was a great collection of assets, but it allowed them to get breadth and width across Europe. Okay. We talked a little bit about the 420 acquisition last time, which they not only got a great asset and sort of a quasi brand, but they got a great management team that's now running sort of Curaleaf Germany and maybe even will run at some point in time Curaleaf International. Mm-hmm. Recently, Curaleaf's even amped up their strategic business development team, and you know they're out hunting for other assets across Europe. In fact, I think Curaleaf announced an acquisition in Poland either last week or the week before, which was a wholesaler in Poland, just to kind of raise the flag that Poland is an interesting economy to look at from a cannabis angle. So I think that when you look at the public MSOs, there, you know, today there are operators in Germany that are Tilray and Aurora, and there's a third domestic operator called Demican, all in the cultivation side. But when you look at where Curaleaf sits, I think that they're kind of the superior play to take advantage of the German regs and ultimately the liberalization of the European regs. So from a public market side, I'd kind of flag those guys. On the private side, depending on where you want to play in the supply chain, there are other operators that are out there, not with that sort of complete set of components that Bloomwell has, but there are folks like Cansativa that have access to the RFP that Germany puts out, and it actually manages and distributes Germany's own medical cannabis program. So if the state is buying and supplying the medical program with cannabis, it's Cansativa that is handling that. There are other companies that have done, you know, tolling services, listing services, but you start getting very fragmented and very small very quickly. There have been tremendous, I can't remember if it's, you know, 80 or 100, but there were many, many sort of small distribution licenses that were handed out. And I think a lot of those businesses are kind of going out. So you do need to have critical mass, even in a single market like Germany.
Okay, I just want to understand what you're saying. So let's just go back a second to cultivation. There are only three cultivation licenses in Germany, true or false?
Yes, true.
Okay, and as I understand it, Aphria has one. Oh, sorry, Tilray, I should say, has one. Aurora has one, and then Demican, which is private, is the third.
Correct.
And when they grow, can they sell to any operator, or are they only selling to the government through the RFP?
They can sell directly to pharmacies. So they don't. They can supply the RFP, but they would be selling into Cansativa to supply that. What they typically do is they, you know, in Germany, there's kind of the 80-20 rule as it comes to pharmacy sales. And they're really, you know, 80% of the cannabis volume goes through 20% of the top tier players. And actually of that, there are probably only five major pharmacies. And again, remember in Germany, you don't have these large chains of pharmacies. You have specialty pharmacies because it has to be a real person that holds two licenses, or you have the opportunity to run two pharmacies under a single license. There's not a large chain. So there are only like five kind of pharmacies that tilt 80% of the market as far as volume of cannabis. And so Demican can sell into those pharmacies directly, sell their product into those pharmacies directly. I think that there have been caps on what the total production is for folks like Demican as far as what they can produce and sell into the market. And those caps, I think, are going to be expanded under this new medical program. So there will be more robust domestic supply coming into the marketplace. And I think that for the better operators who are cultivators, their kind of secret sauce right now is going out and finding unique strains that either the private market wants, so some sort of quasi-California type of strains, mm-hmm. or strains that really either patients or doctors, more importantly, gravitate to. So they can do a little bit of supply segregation and focus on, you know, higher quality strains than what's available today, especially if they don't irradiate. One of the sort of under tiers of German cannabis is that much of the cannabis that's sold has been irradiated. And from a consumer standpoint or patient standpoint, it really dries out or changes the natural state of raw cannabis. And so
irradiation, for those who don't know, is almost like microwaving the bud, right? To, exactly. to get it, you know, clean, quote unquote, or kill, you know, kill any potential mold, right? But of course, you know, you microwave your weed, it's not the best quality you get out on the other end of it, right?
And you lose the sponginess in the morphology. So what some of the better operators are able to do is not go through an irradiation process, but are still able to remediate things like bacterial contamination with mm-hmm. a non-irradiated source. And then you have a nicer, more robust flower that has still a terpene profile. It doesn't smell like dry grass. It's gassy. It smells like the cannabis that you want to have it smell like. And those operators that have good strains and are able to produce kind of non-irradiated flower that the market can buy will actually, at least in this near-term time frame, will win. They'll have, you know, positive market selection going towards those more quality strains. And that's where players like Demican can really set themselves apart.
So let's just back up for a second, because I think when you take a look at what we're saying, right? Market's $500 million roughly, or euro, sorry, roughly. You know, the price per gram sounds pretty high, right?
It's around 8 to 10 euro per gram. So it's not terribly.
It's better than I thought, yeah.
Yep.
So fair enough. So probably in line. Yeah, probably in line, right? Maybe some room to come down, but not crazy. Like, I mean, it's not like it used to be, you know, $20 a gram back in the day, right? Mm-hmm. So why, and maybe talk a little bit on the ground, like how big are those facilities for those three cultivators? Because you would think that if you say, look, this program's about to explode, it could be doubling over the next couple of years, you would think that the three domestic cultivators would get a lot of benefit from that. And someone like Aurora, for example, has a pretty small market cap these days. You would think any kind of positive news like that would be, you know, a big catalyst for them.
I think the issue with each of those domestic cultivators is that to expand their facility, they're going to have to make new investment because they've been mm-hmm. running them under this current program. So they didn't sure. overexpand. Demican actually has a really nice facility. It's inside of an old rendering facility outside of Leipzig, but they've built out capacity right now to service this market and to service a little bit over the size of this market. But if they really wanted to service a much larger market, they need to make new investments. So there is an issue of a little bit of a holdback just from current capacity. But they are also competing with all three of these guys are competing with, you know, Northern Macedonia that's bringing in cannabis at incredibly low cost. Colombia that's bringing in cannabis. A lot of these, you know, non-EU based cultivators have very high quality cannabis at much lower costs. Hmm. And so it comes down to margin and pricing. You are sort of capped on what you can sell. Although again, if you brought in like a very special THCV or a 30% THC cannabis strain, and you're really only focused on the private pay market, not the sort of German RFP market, you theoretically could sell into that marketplace. But I do think that the long-term effect of being a domestic cultivator is that, you know, you're paying German labor costs, German power costs, German water costs. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty expensive toll to go through when you think about, let's take Colombia, for example, where you're growing with, you know, labor that's, it's not costless, but it's very low cost. Abundant sunlight. So you don't really have a lot of an electrical need, because if you look at Aurora, Tilray and Demican, they're all indoor facilities. So you're competing with still high quality greenhouse supply. It may not be that same robust indoor bud, but you're getting really well-valued, very nice cannabis from low-cost jurisdictions, then as price comes down, you're going to be bumping into that. So again, today, I think that these domestic operators can make a lot of money. We just, from a investment standpoint, we just worry about the longer term effect. And the smarter folks, and I really like the Dan McCann team. I think they're super smart guys, great entrepreneurs. You know, the better teams will be able to continue to pivot, and they'll, you know, be able to consume either 100% of their own capacity in a more downstream business. If you think about the expansion of modality, if you get from flower to oil to something else, there's a new category to go into. So I wouldn't count them out, but I just think that from a pure economic standpoint, they have a much higher hurdle to get over than someone who's coming in from, you know, low cost jurisdiction, even coming out of Portugal, which is much lower in cost for production than it is in Germany.
Interesting. So right now with the current medical landscape and even with it expanding, it sounds like it's not so easy for the domestic guys, right? They're competing with the rest of the world. Is it? And would you, like, if you were to guess, how much of that 500 million current market is being supplied by the domestic suppliers?
Oh, a fourth of it.
Fourth of it. Okay. It's actually better than I thought though, right? You're talking 100 million plus.
Capacity. I think today total capacity right now is about 5 tons coming out of those three folks versus 21 tons that were sold. Again, I'm using 2022 data right now. So if we go to 100 tons, they could expand and still sort of keep a nice toehold. They can still make a lot of money. So I'm not counting out domestic operators at all. But for new investment dollars going in, we're not looking for just what's happening tomorrow. We're looking for what's happening kind of 3 to 5 years from now when we want to exit. And we really just in general like asset-light models much more so than we like asset-heavy models or CapEx-heavy models. So again, this may be sort of more of a flavor of Artemis versus the broader market. Again, I don't want to count out a Tilray or an Aurora or a Demican. But as far as the real opportunity for us as an investor, we're not focused on cultivation.
Understood. And I think it's very helpful to understand how you think about it and why you guys did what you did long term, right? But I guess what I'm trying to just hone in on, in Aurora, for example, you know, they're a relatively small company these days and they, you know, can't seem to catch a break. Do you think with the program expanding, they have an opportunity to make enough money that actually moves the needle for them as a public company?
You know, I think Aurora has been doing a lot of things outside of cannabis to try and you know, buy down their overall exposure and create capital and profit wherever they can. Mm-hmm. I think Germany is going to be a very nice opportunity for them to lean in. They just pulled out of France because, you know, France is legalizing, but they're doing it only through finished products. So they're not going to be opening flower as a medical category in France. So Aurora had been really supplying for free the French government under the pilot program, and they just pulled out of that. So they can redirect that supply to Germany. They can sell it from either the domestic supplier, bring it in from Canada. So there is certainly an opportunity for anybody who is already incumbent in Germany or even new players coming to the table to say that this is going to be a very robust market and I can step in. But that is against a very large pipeline of other flower producers that want to come into Germany as well. So you still have to have a USP there to say why your cannabis is going to be better positioned on the shelf for the patient. That could be supply chain access. You're already in with some of the pharmacies. That could be cost. That could be cultivar selection. But I do think that it's an opportunity for Aurora. I just don't know what the impact is going to be on their overall operations and if it's going to move the needle for their stock. I do think that it's certainly a business opportunity for Aurora and others to access now that this market's going to expand.
Yeah, so that'll be something to watch, right? It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. So sure. Going back to what you mentioned before about Pillar 2, right? And the idea that eventually there'll be this pilot program that comes out. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this, but if you're doing a pilot program with REC, would that need to be supplied by domestic growers as opposed to internationally supplied product?
100%. And that's how it's being done right now in both Switzerland and in the Netherlands. You cannot cross a border with a recreational cannabis product. So by definition, to be in compliance with a UN single convention, you cannot import cannabis for recreational sales, even under this scientific pilot program. So that pilot program is going to be 100% supplied by the three domestic licenses. They may expand those licenses. For example, in the Netherlands, they issued new licenses to some of the selected coffee shops to say you have now a cultivation partner
right,
Netherlands, and that's likely going to be the same state in Germany, which is there are three suppliers right now. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of consternation around if there will be or not new licenses issued, but you can see an opportunity to say in the expanded program under Pillar 2 that you'd want to have more than just three suppliers of cannabis. You may not want to have, you know, 30 suppliers, but you may want to have, you know, three goes to five or three goes to 10 to be able to have one, a sharing of the economics, two, more data, and then three, you know, better service for the patient and the consumer who's going to be playing in that new sort of pilot adult use program.
Yeah, so it's a good point, right? Even if Pillar 2 comes, which I guess you tell me, is there any idea of timing on that, or is that totally like out in the future?
I mean, I would be speculating. I think that it's pushed off for now because the focus has really been on Pillar 1 and getting Pillar 1 through codified and non-narcotic status established as the law of the land. I think the worry right now is that the government in Germany may change before you get to Pillar 2.
Right.
And right now, you know, there was a lot of very vociferous debate over what the adult use or quasi-adult use status is of cannabis. And really the CDU, the Christian Democratic Party, which is the conservative party, almost like the Republicans of Germany, they're very against the expansion into adult use. And interestingly enough, they're actually very supportive of the medical program. So if Pillar 2 ever comes to light, I think that it really depends on a lot of factors because it's not just going to be under the wings of the traffic light coalition. If you get a governmental change, you're going to have to be dealing with a completely different paradigm. And that may say that this thing gets pushed off, you know, for a much longer time.
Interesting. Interesting. So, well, we're running out of time here, but there's a couple of interesting topics I want to make sure we hit on. So just to round out kind of what we're saying here, in terms of the investment opportunities and specifically the public companies, because I think that's where people are going to be you know, the most interested. We think about a Curaleaf. You know, you're saying that they are well positioned. They got a lot going on there and they have a good team. But again, Curaleaf is a big company, right? I mean, that's maybe 10 times the size of Aurora.
Right.
It sounds like even if this program grows, maybe it might be difficult for them to move the needle in terms of how much they're actually able to capture from the program.
I mean, Curaleaf is they're still primarily driven out of the U.S. And so, you know, revenue-wise, I think that, you know, Europe is a fraction of what overall revenues are out of the U.S. So will this move the needle? I mean, one, maybe on expectation and kind of investor sentiment. I think you will see kind of translation through on operations and margins. Will that move the overall needle of market cap of Curaleaf? Somewhat, but, you know, are you going to go from, you know, 0 to 10 or, you know, 1 to 20? I'm not really sure how big the impact's going to be. I think that time will tell. If you're a smaller market cap company like an Aurora or and you do have uplift, then theoretically your stock should be bouncing higher just because you're a smaller number going to a larger number rather than a large number going to a slightly larger number.
Yeah, more torque on it, you know. And like you said, a lot of it's sentiment, right?
A lot of it. You look in the entire cannabis space today, I get really – you know, sketchy talking about trends in legal publicly traded cannabis, because especially for the US operators, but really for anyone who's listed, there's, you know, I keep on tearing down tear sheets and saying, where's the institutional support here? You don't really have true institutional capital in legal cannabis in the public markets. It's still a retail driven non-institutional market. And so until we get something changing in the US, like Schedule 1 going to Schedule 3 and sort of the DEA coming out and saying, okay, cannabis is no longer a narcotic. It removes a lot of the issues. Maybe we get some capital markets uplift there. You will start to see institutional capital flow into those markets. But it really, I think that the bulwark there, the blocking piece is really US law. And so until you have some permissibility that comes around legal investing in cannabis. When we talk about public stocks, I just stop the conversation because I'm not talking across the table to an institutional investor. When I start talking about, you know, revenue multiples, EBITDA multiples, profit, you know, cannabis trades at 1 to 2 times revenue when a consumer company or even an alcohol or tobacco company trades at 5 to 10 times revenue. So you can put as much research out there. There's kind of no one on the other side. There's no institutional party reading this stuff. Maybe portfolio managers are playing on their PA into index funds, but you don't have a BlackRock, a Fidelity, a Federated. You don't have mainline mutual funds buying cannabis companies because they can't. So it's really a retail play, and it kind of means that everything is up to investor sentiment, much more so than up to, you know, what metrics look like, KPIs, revenue hurdles, margin, because very few people are doing that math. They're kind of buying on speculation, and you see it in the volatility. They buy and it goes up. They sell, it goes down. The market is just highly volatile, and there's really no one building and holding long-term positions to support the industry.
Yeah, no question. So listen, two things quickly before we wrap up here I want to make sure we touch on. So, you know, we've talked about all these great things for Germany, right? One thing that I think it's important that we chat about is just, well, is it really all that great for Germany? Because in terms of the medical market, because, you know, I think about New York, for example. Mm. New York had a small, limited, but you know, alive medical program. And when legalization passed in New York a couple of years ago, but they were in that in-between transitional period of not having a legal place to buy it, the effect of decriminalization in New York really killed the medical program. And we had a listener who would kind of give us periodic updates on what was happening with her, you know, the Curaleaf store that she went to. And she said it actually got harder and worse because of some changes they made to the medical program, which is, you know, not the same in Germany. But, you know, it sounded like the decrim in New York actually ended up really hurting the medical operators, because essentially it just didn't make sense to keep going there when you could just buy it on any street corner at a reduced price with no tax and no headache. So I guess just quickly on that, you know, that's obviously something I think about as a risk. Are you worried about that? Not worried about that? How do you think about that?
You know, I we've seen all of the negative pitfalls of decrim in the U.S., whether it's Germany or Oklahoma. I mean, pick any state that said, you know, on this day, you know, cannabis is no longer going to be illegal. And all of a sudden, mm-hmm. without enforcement, the illegality popped up. Even in California, you know, buying burner distribution licenses, sticking things in a Sprinter van and then sending to another state. Mm-hmm. Like the lack of enforcement there just fueled the illicit market to get stronger. Totally. I think the difference in Germany is that, one, there is a fairly robust medical program today. Two, mm-hmm. that program already has a significant amount of reimbursement. And even if you don't choose to go through the reimbursement channel, you have significant choice. Mm-hmm. And cannabis is incredibly low priced. Like you don't have this competition. I mean, talk to Ben Kovler at GTI. Who's your biggest competitor? It's not Curaleaf. It's not Boris. It's the illicit guy selling, you know, down the block. Mm-hmm. So you don't have that in Germany. The last thing is, or well, not the last thing, but one of the more important things is you do have enforcement in Germany. Like there will mm-hmm. be a very strong focus on, you know, legal access and then everything else, even the cannabis clubs and the individual side. While it's a ticket, if you're out of compliance, they're still going to be enforcing it. Like we're talking about Germany. We're not talking mm-hmm. about, you know, laissez-faire New York City, which has a really difficult thing because a lot of the people that are illegally selling in New York, they frankly should have a card license. They want to. It's just that, you know, it's an underfunded administrative group that's been running that program. And until the licenses catch up, you're going to have a lot of illegal sales. And until enforcement catches up, you're going to have a lot of illegal sales. So you don't have that same issue. Pricing is at parity or below the illicit market. Mm-hmm. You have strong enforcement around what's legal and what's not legal. You have many points of contact. Again, like going through the Bloomwell site, you can get 95% of your cannabis on your computer and it arrives at your door. Right. So I don't think you have the same components of worry that you do in the US. But, you know, we'll see. I think that you know, anytime you decriminalize something like cannabis, it opens up a whole series of opportunities for the illicit market to kind of bleed through. I just think that Germany has a much better mechanism in place to kind of keep illegal and legal separate.
Okay, great. I'm glad we touched on that. So lastly here, one thing we teased at the beginning that I really want for you to talk about is you mentioned that in the UK, there are some things that you're working on and involved in from a legislative perspective, which might really help open the capital markets, not for, you know, US plant touching operators, but for everybody else. And just to, you know, set it up, I think one thing you mentioned to me that I didn't understand was that if you are a legal operator, let's say in Canada or in Germany, you may technically be able to list on the London exchange, but there's a lot of restrictions that essentially make it very, very difficult for institutional investors to buy or sell the stock. So maybe just quickly talk about what it's like today and what you would be hoping to change and how that, what impact that could have.
So today, you know, the issue is called the Proceeds of Crime Act, or POCA, P-O-C-A for short.
Okay.
And what that says is everything is illegal except for the things that are legal. And here are the things that are legal. Alcohol is actually one of the legal sort of industries that otherwise would be illegal and is written into POCA. So as a, again, this affects UK money, UK investors, and UK citizens. So if you want to buy, for example, if you wanted to invest in Bloomwell, and you're a UK citizen holding a UK passport, you would have to file something called a SAR, a suspicious activities report, because Bloomwell, if you imported Bloomwell's business model to the UK, theoretically, it's an illegal business because the UK applies its laws, its domestic laws, to any company outside of the UK border. And so from a friction point standpoint, whether you're an individual or an institution or a corporate, you have a huge friction point and an encumbrance that creates, one, a lot of risk, and two, a lot of administrative headache. So it really almost chokes off the entire capital flow from UK investors and UK corporates into cannabis. You can list today, you know, Bloomwell can list on the London Stock Exchange or on the AIM, one of the UK exchanges, but it's kind of a so what event if you don't really have the money there to make the exchange a robust exchange. Mm-hmm. And then the second kind of knock-on effect is not just the capital market side, but it's actually UK domestic industry. There's not a lot of capital that flows freely into these private companies to build an industry, even though, you know, the UK legalized a medical state-run cannabis program in, or state-sponsored, I should say, in 2018. Germany started in 2017, and we're at maybe 20,000, 30,000 patients in the UK today. And these are mm-hmm. patients that actually churn out of the market because they find that the supply chain in the UK is very underfunded and the choice is very low versus the illicit market that supplies, you know, tremendous amounts of cannabis and all these different choices and all these different modalities. So because of the Proceeds of Crime Act, just use the control of the UK versus Germany, the UK should be at or above Germany's kind of robust medical market today. But because of this lack of capital flow, it really hasn't happened. So where we've been active, we spoke at Parliament a couple of months ago. We're still behind the scenes trying to work with the parliamentarians to talk about, you know, just make a few changes. In fact, look at Jersey, which did an amendment to POCA to include cannabis, and look at the effect there to open up that market for investment. Actually, recently, I think just a week ago, Jersey announced that they're decriminalizing cannabis from a personal possession standpoint. The opportunity for the UK is if you repeal POCA, you're going to have a free flow of capital coming in. That means the exchanges actually aren't just going to be sort of static exchanges, but you'll finally have a dynamic flow of buyers and sellers. You'll actually have a robust capital market on the LSE and the AIM. You'll have all of the picks and shovels to support this industry. Lawyers, accountants, service providers, investors, banks, et cetera, will want to lean into this rather than lean out. Because again, if you are a lawyer and you're billing a cannabis company, you have to file a SAR to get paid. So there's not a lot of folks showing up to raise their hands to say that we want to service the industry. And then ultimately, if you look at the analog of the US, you know, in 2022, there were 428,000 permanent jobs in the US created by the cannabis industry. Mm-hmm. And from first legal state sales until December 2022, there was $15 billion of tax revenue generated in cannabis. That last year in 2022, like California itself was a billion. And so when you look at the UK, that could be 250,000 to a half million jobs, 2 to 5 billion of tax revenue. It creates a domestic industry, it creates a capital markets footprint, and it creates an opportunity for actually London to be the financial center for global cannabis. Because the US is going to be, you know, sort of stuck up in its own bindings for quite some time. So I think that where government gets kind of traction here, whether it's Tory or Labour, is they see jobs and revenue, they see cost savings on policing, they see the financial impact of having a product on the national health system that actually maybe is better for patients in many situations. So it's kind of the first kind of hole in the dike, if you will, to allow more free flow of capital to come into the markets, support these businesses, grow a domestic industry, have free flow of capital in the capital markets, mm-hmm. and create kind of a robust nest of opportunity for cannabis in the UK. But right now, we're not there. So that's why we as a firm and folks like the adjacent businesses, even some of the cannabis businesses, are funding into this opportunity to create better awareness around what we have in the UK and better awareness around what the opportunity is for politicians. And frankly, when you start talking jobs and dollars, people listen. So we're hopeful that we will see some change this year, even in POCA. And we're pushing hard to try and make that change happen.
So just to summarize what you're saying, basically, if they change this Proceeds of Crime Act, just to include a couple of lines to say that cannabis, if it's legal, if the business is legal, it's permitted, right? So that wouldn't include, you know, U.S. operators, to be clear, because they're still federally illegal.
Right.
But it would include, you know, the Canadian businesses, the German businesses, et cetera. Then that would potentially open up the London Stock Exchange and allow companies to list there and bring in capital. And you gave an example of Jersey. And to be clear, you're not talking about New Jersey. You're talking about a tiny country, I think, right? Off the island of England and France.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So it's basically a tiny country which recently did this, changed the Proceeds of Crime Act. So basically if England copies that and does the same thing, that would open up potentially the LSE, which is, you know, a major exchange, right, for some of the cannabis businesses.
And I'll say in defense of the LSE, they say we're open today. But the reality is you're not open until you have buyers and sellers. And one of the key components are the domestic institutional providers of capital in the UK. And they are cordoned off because of Proceeds of Crime right now. So we actually want the LSE to stand behind this to help us with a change, because what you don't have are active flows of capital. You have kind of the technical opportunity to list without really bringing buyers and sellers together, because you're cutting off this huge chunk of capital that is the UK institutional community.
Yeah, I mean, if you have to file a suspicious activity report with the government every time you want to buy or sell a stock, it's not really a very good marketplace for buying and selling, right?
That is not a free flow of capital.
It's not very liquid, I guess we would say.
Right.
So Will, just coming to the end here, I want to give you the last word. Anything you want to leave people with on Germany, and then maybe as well what this could mean for, you know, the rest of the world, including the US, and you know, maybe rescheduling, which we didn't really talk about today.
So I'm very excited about Germany. I think that we're very sanguine, very, very positive about where Europe is going to open up over the next couple of years. We're not here to overpump or overhype the opportunity. This is still a relatively small market that's going to grow much more in a steadfast step-by-step process than kind of a big bang. But when we look at where the domestic market is today, we do think that the incumbent operators are going to be really pulled in that updraft of wealth creation. And so investing today in Germany is a great time to be investing. Picking spots throughout Europe is also a great place. Denmark is great. France is going to open up soon. The frustration has been really around the UK as it relates to the European states, but we're hopefully making changes there. Where I do get excited, I'm very happy that HHS came out in the US to say that cannabis shouldn't be Schedule One, because by the CSA, by the Controlled Substances Act, the DEA must adhere to the medical advice of HHS. So DEA can do their own thing as far as where it gets scheduled. They can also have a lot of delays. Like, there's no direct line that this is immediately going to happen.
Right.
But there is such political context around cannabis as it relates to the election coming up. And if this is a Trump-Biden election, it's actually quite within the realm of possibility that this summer or even late this spring, we have the DEA coming out to say that this is a Schedule 3. And if that moves cannabis from a narcotic status to non-narcotic status, still a controlled substance, it removes some big impediments to the cannabis industry in the U.S., primarily like 280E, and it opens the door to things like cross-border, you know, state-to-state interstate commerce. It doesn't do everything. It doesn't make cannabis, you know, federally legal, but it's certainly an important first step. It will take years kind of after that change to kind of say who is in charge, like, is this FDA oversight, who's running U.S. cannabis. But I'll say in general that Germany is a tipping point for the world, because it shows what a legal process can result in as far as positive effect that's beneficial to the patient, beneficial to the society, beneficial to the cannabis operators, and it creates a very positive, holistic effect on the industry overall. that we think will be a bellwether for Europe. When we start looking beyond this, we can start dreaming about what a global cannabis reform will look like that will include and necessitate the US to change their stance on federal illegality. But it feels like we are continuing to move in the right direction. So in the most conservative way, we are very happy about what's going on. We will continue to do what we've done, which is invest in good companies, good teams, and in the best opportunities that we see. But we invite others to at least analyze the European opportunity and say, you know, maybe this is worth the time to spend to learn what's happening over here, because we think that Europe is going to open up faster than what we may see in the US. And again, it's a smaller market, more step-by-step approach. But we love, as investors, highly regulated markets. I was a healthcare banker for many years before this. Mm-hmm. If you're servicing the patient well within the confines of legal law and regulatory order, you can make a lot of money, create very strong businesses, ultimately have very successful outcomes for investors. But importantly, you're servicing the patient, you're servicing the supply chain, you're in servicing the employees, and you're servicing the community in which these businesses operate. And for us, that's nirvana. It's this holistic 360 approach of value creation. And importantly, we're impact investors, and we're very focused on destigmatizing cannabis, bringing it into the mainstream, and removing this taint. And I think that especially for marginalized communities and those that have been most hurt by the war on drugs, this is actually a really good step forward to open up the conversation to say, why is it illegal? Let's make this legal everywhere. So we're hopeful that the conversation goes much further than where it is today. And we see that there's momentum there to do so. So we're pretty happy about where we stand.
Will, sorry, just on you brought this up, and I think, you know, should at least touch on this to close. So just rescheduling, right? Because that's what obviously a lot of us are focused on. If that proposed rule drops tomorrow, from an institutional perspective, you talked about the fact that there's just no institutional buyers at the table, you know, or very few, and kind of, you know, maybe have an eye on it, maybe don't. What do you think it takes for them to get involved? Do you think that if that, you know, proposed rule drops and, you know, there's a comment period and there's uncertainty and there's a timing, do you think they jump in right away? Do you think they wait for the rule to be crystallized? Like, what, how do you look at it, you know, in your conversations with institutional investors?
It depends on if we're talking to like a Goldman Sachs or a Fidelity or you know, like JP Morgan or BlackRock. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Or if we're talking to, you know, a hedge fund that's okay sort of being in that liminal space between. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is a level of capital that will come into the market. There'll be a lot of speculation. You'll probably see, you know, with a DEA announcement, you'll see stocks going up 4 or 5 times. They'll probably settle back down
You say 4 or 5 times?
4 or 5 times in price, yeah. Look at what happened around, just, and again, this is like craziness, right? Look at what happened when SAFE was expected to go through. And every time, I mean, GTI went up to like $48 a share at one point in time. They're back down at like 16, but you had crazy speculation because these are low volume stocks. There's not a lot of market cap out there, and movement happens pretty quickly. But that's kind of the initial peak. I think it settles back down to like a more normalized range, which could be still a 2x over where we are today as far as general market cap, general pricing of cannabis stocks.
I think people are very happy they waited to the end to hear this, by the way. They're very excited to hear you say this. Keep going.
But this, again, from an
institution. We're spitballing here. I get it, right?
But we don't want like crazy volatility. We want sort of, you know, long-term gains being made because of company operations. But I do think that with the descheduling announcement, if that gets announced and DEA is really behind this and we see cannabis moving to Schedule 3, for example, that you will have institutional money flowing from kind of these non-Fed borrowing window players. Until you get full federal legalization, the idea of federal permissibility, I think, is still going to be very difficult for folks like BlackRock, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan. Mm. Until you get sort of the from top down that the SEC is not going to call you in violation of breaking federal law, you're not going to see those houses move into investing in cannabis. But you will see a lot of folks that are hedge funds that already play in different spaces that are kind of a little bit out there coming into the marketplace. So there should be a resetting of cannabis valuations to something above where they are today. I don't think it's going to be set at 4 to 5 times and stay there. I think it pops up and then drops back down. I think that we see profit taking taken, and maybe you get kind of market caps going from one to two rather than one from one to five and staying there. But over time, it's the right direction because eventually you will have something that's more permanent on the federal position, and it's going to be a political issue. You know, we've now moved cannabis from narcotic to non-narcotic, you know, in a post Schedule 3 world. The question is going to be, well, why don't we just sort of make it on par with alcohol? Why don't we just leave this as a consumer product? There's a medical aspect to it, but there's a consumer aspect to it. Why do we have these federal prohibition laws that still exist? And that's the next conversation to happen after kind of this next stage, which is DEA saying that they support a non-Schedule 1 status for cannabis. But it's going to take...
Yeah, I think as you know, as we talked about with Germany, everything happens in phases, right? And maybe not as quickly as we'd like, but to your point, you know, you're going to have some faster money coming in. You're going to have some upwards movement. You know, hopefully the kind of numbers you're talking about would be nice, right? But then to your point, it's also going to settle down to a different degree, but hopefully a much higher degree than where we are today. And there will still be another wave of capital that won't come in until it's the all federal legal clear, yes, which, you know, will take much longer to come in. So, Will, I just really want to thank you for this chat today. I think this was a really insightful conversation. Will Mucchi, Artemis Growth Partners. Thank you, everyone, for listening. CINpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time.
This podcast is a general communication and entertainment being provided for informational purposes only. It is educational in nature and not designed to be a recommendation for any specific investment product, strategy, plan, feature, or other purposes. Any examples used in this podcast are generic, hypothetical, and for entertainment purposes only. None of Cannabis Investing Network or its affiliates are suggesting that the listener or any other person take a specific course of action or any action at all. Communications such as this are not impartial and are provided in connection with advertising and marketing of products and services. Prior to making any investment or financial decisions, an investor should seek individualized advice from a personal financial, legal, tax, and other professional advisor that take into account all of the particular facts and circumstances for an investor's own situation. By listening to this communication, you agree with the intended purpose described earlier. Opinions and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions constitute our judgment and are subject to change without notice. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors.